Blog Talk Radio.
Now, PW Torch and Spreaker bring you the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show. It's time to talk this week's WWE Friday Night SmackDown on Fox.
So, Mike, we've got ourselves an Intercontinental title tournament, and I gotta say, I give WWE a good grade for how they built this up. We had the brackets. We had a number of top contenders. We have AJ Styles floating over from Raw as part of a brand-to-brand invitational policy. And Daniel Bryan cutting a fiery promo. And the announcers talking about the IC title being the workhorse title that all wrestlers who have pride in their match quality want. I thought they hit a lot of bullet points that made it seem like they're not just phoning in this tournament or assuming knowledge about the title. Did that stand out to you at all tonight?
Yeah, absolutely. And I totally agree. I think that the early returns on this so far, obviously 1 week in only, but I think they're really good because there's a lot of elements that you just mentioned there. The Daniel Bryan promo stuck out a lot to me, and it kind of harkens back to when he did have the IC title briefly after WrestleMania 31. He made it very clear how he wanted to make it feel like an important championship, like one of the most important championships. It was at a time where, you know, you had guys kind of filtering in and out as world champion, namely Brock Lesnar, and he wanted that to be the title that was always seen and was always defended. And it feels like that's the direction he wants to take it in again. And to me, he's probably the favorite in this tournament. But the beauty of this tournament is there is a lot of star power, and it is fairly unpredictable, even regarding who could win these first-round matchups and then go on to win this whole tournament. And I think the first-round matchups in general, really good. I mean, Bryan and Gulak had a fantastic match tonight, and of course, they've been working together for the past couple months. Styles and Nakamura have a built-in rivalry dating back to WrestleMania a couple of years ago. Jeff Hardy and Sheamus have been feuding for the past few weeks. So I think that there's a lot of intertwined storylines that make it very interesting, and a lot of intriguing potential matchups. And like you said, it feels like WWE really is stressing the importance of the IC title, which is something that hasn't always been done over the past several years, especially.
Yeah, I mean, you look at next week's round one matches, Jeff Hardy versus Sheamus. Built-in storyline. Mm-hmm. AJ Styles, Shinsuke Nakamura, history, New Japan, right. Even. And it's, you know, I mean, it's a completely different set of circumstances, and for a wide array of reasons, it's not going to match Tokyo Dome, but it's still a nice first-round matchup, and it's got history there. And then, you know, I mean, the only thing they could have done better this week, I guess, would have been to have something from Jeff Hardy, Sheamus, and Shinsuke verbally to talk up why we should look at them as favorites, like frame it in a realistic way. I think that would have actually augmented what was a good buildup already. Even AJ Styles, like having AJ, and I know, you know, Cole pointed us towards WWE social media platforms to hear from Styles and what this means. And they did their best to frame it, but having Styles call in or, you know, I mean, people are used to when they watch TV now, nobody's got high def, you know, high end camera connections. People are understanding of the fact that not everything is crisp and 1080, I would have done a little bit more, but it sounds, you know, I'm mostly complimentary of what they did, and there's only so much time, but I think it's more a compliment to how much I'm anticipating next week's matches that I sort of wish they did a little bit more to build that up than just announcing it and having the announcers talk about it a bit. But yeah, this is a good tournament. I mean, yes, it had Elias against King Corbin, although it's probably not a popular view, but that was better than my expectations. Now, granted, it still looked like it was a series of practice sequences, and they sports entertained us for 15 plus minutes. And I know it tested some people's patience, but I actually thought this was on the higher end of what we had the right to expect from these two. I thought Elias showed like more fire than usual. And I think they were trying hard to avoid some of the criticism that they were, I think, getting anyway on Twitter and in some SmackDown reports out there. What did you think, Mike? Were you in the camp of, oh, God, get this over with, I can't stand it, or this is actually not as bad as maybe I thought it would be, or somewhere, or, you know, in a different place?
Yeah, you know, I honestly didn't have a big issue with it, but, you know, I think kind of like you, my expectations weren't overly high going into it, especially considering the match that we got at WrestleMania, but I thought this match was far better than that WrestleMania match. And I think part of it is there was some heat there because you had Elias costing Corbin at Money in the Bank, so you had that built in and him wanting to get some level of revenge. So I think that helped the match out a little bit. But again, you know, not every match is going to be a technical classic, and you already had that type of match with Bryan and Gulak. So I think the fact that that match was what it was, you could do something different with Corbin and Elias, and you get a little bit of everything on the show. So I think of all the matches in the tournament, in the first round, obviously, and probably any match we're going to get from this point forward, I think Corbin versus Elias was the one that had the lowest potential to be great. And we're past that now, and it wasn't that bad. It wasn't an offensive match by any means. I felt like it was, you know, it was solid. It was good enough. It was a serviceable match. I didn't have a big issue with it. Like I said, not every match is going to wow you. This one did what it had to do. It got Elias over, and now he has this momentum heading into the second round where he's going to face probably AJ Styles, but potentially even Shinsuke Nakamura. And that match, obviously, I think would have the potential to be far better than even this one was.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think so, too. But, yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. I mean, I thought it was just like a level above serviceable. Mm-hmm. But I think it's a term that applies, and I don't spend a ton of time on it, but I want to, like, if two guys go out there and work hard and they're given this ambitious amount of time to fill, you know, they went longer than Bryan and Gulak, which is going to upset some people, especially who didn't watch the show. And I mean, if your style isn't, if you're very sensitive to what feels like, almost coding, like their matches are coded. Here's this mm-hmm. sequence, and now we're gonna attach it to this sequence, and then attach it to that. And the guitar stuff is kind of hokey, but it is built into who they are and what role they play on SmackDown. But I just want to give credit, I think, where it's due, that wasn't a bad match. I mean, it was not a bad match for the style that they work. I have to put all these qualifiers on it, and they are deserved because it's not, you know. You can't drop that match in the middle of a lot of other places, but for this context and who their characters are, I think they deserve, you know, some measured praise. What do you think of Gulak and Bryan though? I mean, I say we got a little more than we expected with low expectations. With Gulak and Bryan, there's high expectations. Mm-hmm. You knew exactly what you're going to. Well, I shouldn't say you knew, because maybe tempers would flare and it would turn into something different, but this was one of the options we thought, which is, you know, they gave them 12, 13 minutes with a commercial break in the middle. It knocked out, you know, three or so minutes of just those two getting to show off what they can do. And, you know, that was a lot of fun to watch those two people do something so different than what we normally see WWE wrestlers do, because most of them are not capable of anything close to keeping it in the ropes and telling that kind of story. And that ankle Dragon leg whip at the end, and Cole sold it well, and then going right into the leg lock to tap out was I thought, you know, the heel hook. I thought it was a really cool finishing sequence too.
Yeah, I loved the match. I thought it was fantastic. Maybe not quite on the level of the pay per view match they had a few months back, but that got significantly more time and it had more of a spotlight. And it was also kind of the first time that we had seen them wrestle in WWE, so it was a little bit different. But this match was different from that, and it was fantastic in its own right, though. I just thought – I love the styles and how they mesh so well, Bryan and Gulak. It's just that chemistry that they have in the ring is so obvious when they wrestle, and it was just awesome. And like you said, it's so different from any other match that we see in WWE generally. It was a technical masterclass. Just it felt like real – you know, amateur wrestling almost, with the way that they're countering and they have an answer and they're always kind of probing and looking for a way to prey on a weakness and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Like it's just such good storytelling in the ring. And they're both so good at it. Two of the best in the world, probably, at that style of wrestling. And I just, you know, it was just enjoyable. Like, you know, that these guys storyline and in real life are friends. So it's not like there's no issue there. And they mentioned that on commentary, which I appreciated. But, you know, they both want to be Intercontinental Champion. They both want to take that championship and make it important. And I think that alone was a good enough story in this match. And it made, you know, all the work that they did in between the ropes feel important. I just thought they both did a fantastic job in that match. And again, it's just, you don't see it often. So when you do, it feels special.
Yeah. Yep. Well, let's pause and set the table. Let's introduce ourselves. This is the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast. Actually, it's the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show. Mark for edit. For Friday, May 15th, 2020. We're on live right after SmackDown ended, or about 5 minutes after SmackDown ended. We start our live stream. And I am Wade Keller, host of the program, joined by Mike Chiari from Ring Rust Radio and Bleacher Report. Thank you, Mike, for joining me. Welcome to the co-host chair.
Thanks so much for having me. Always enjoy it.
Good to have you back. How's life?
Not too bad. You know, under the circumstances, just getting by like everybody.
Yeah. So how do you feel about sports and empty stadium or small socially spaced crowds? Like, are you just kind of like following it on a day-to-day basis, hoping they do it? Are you not sure they should? Just kind of what's your capsule opinion on that? Because I know you cover so many sports for Bleacher Report.
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously I'm following all the storylines every single day about, you know, all the conversations and the potential plans that are being discussed. And, you know, it really all comes down to, you know, what is safe, really. And I understand that, you know, all of these leagues want to have their seasons, you know, especially like the NBA and the NHL, because they were so late into the regular seasons when the seasons got suspended. So obviously they'd like to find a way to at least have the playoffs and crown a champion in both of those sports. But it's a tough situation because, yeah, I think that if they are going to restart at some point, and if Major League Baseball is going to start at some point, I think that the seasons would have to start with no fans in attendance. But there's so much more at work there. Like, if you're centralizing where all of these people are going to be, are they going to have to be away from their families for a few months straight? And if they are they going to accept that? And then in Major League Baseball, there's the whole payment situation where the owners want to offer a 50-50 revenue split, but the players don't want to do it because their salaries are never tied to revenue in any other year. So it's going to be a difficult thing to figure out on so many levels for all these sports. And the problem is, you know, time is of the essence, especially with the NBA and the NHL, since their regular seasons begin in October. You can't go too late necessarily, or else you'll have to start the next seasons later, or you put other seasons in jeopardy. So I think that's going to be the real issue. Can they find a real solution and a real way to start these leagues in enough time to be able to not put the next season in jeopardy?
Good summary of everything going on. You know, the pros and cons and the challenges they face, and yeah, the whole aspect of paying the players and the owners feeling like they're being treated fairly, and then the risk and being away from their families. It's
right.
I mean, it's a fascinating, complex, unexpected number of dilemmas and challenges, and then you just have the aesthetics of watching sports in empty venues and,
right.
and how that looks. Now, I grew up a North Star fan, so I'm used to that. You know, the old Minnesota North Stars at the Met Center had some down years where you could buy a ticket in the last row and sit second row and not have anyone within 25 feet of you. It was some tough times, even though this is a state of hockey. The North Stars struggled at times to draw attendance. And you know, I self-deprecatingly made the joke that the Timberwolves have been, you know, preparing for this moment all season with the lowest attendance in the league. So for teams that are used to, you know, just rabid fans and sellout crowds and waiting lists, and we certainly have that with the Minnesota Wild now, it's a big change. And mm-hmm. obviously completely empty versus, you know, a few thousand or even 6,000 in an 18,000 building is massively different. And as we've seen with AEW, even just some noise is better. So yeah, it's, I mean, obviously real world stuff takes precedence and is way more important than, you know, the health and of people and getting the economy back up and running and all that is important. But on this sidebar aspect of it, sports, it's fascinating. And watching wrestling do its thing and try to figure it out, at least the big two brands, has been a journey, and I'm surprised it hasn't gotten more. Do you think in the sports world in general, the mainstream sports reporters and fans are like fully aware that WWE and AEW never stopped? It seems like that would be brought up more. And I just, is it either watch it and know about it or you're not paying attention? I mean, it trends on Twitter. I would think people know. Do you think people know?
I think that it depends who you are. I think there are some that know, but I think there are a lot of people who are just ignorant to professional wrestling. That's not to come off as a slight. They just don't know about it or don't care about it. And
I'm sure,
you know,
many people take it as a compliment. So
right.
No problem.
but you know, I feel like And that's kind of what the narrative is in terms of the quote unquote, you know, real sports or the sports that aren't predetermined, is that, you know, because NASCAR is coming back on Sunday for the first time in a couple of months, no fans in attendance, and all the commercials are finally the return of major league sports. That's kind of what it is. It's like, you know, WWE and AEW have been running this entire time, but I think that unless you grew up a wrestling fan, or else unless you are a wrestling fan, if you're somebody that covers sports, I feel like professional wrestling is kind of looked down upon at times. So WWE and AEW have been doing it, and they have been kind of maybe setting forth a blueprint that maybe some sports are going to have to follow at some point. But I do feel like despite the fact that they have been running still, there's a lot of people that cover sports and a lot of people that follow sports who don't realize it or just don't really give it the time of day because they don't feel like it's on the same level as, you know, a sport like the NBA or like the NFL or whatever it may be.
And it is very different. I mean, obviously, pro wrestling is very different. There's so many other considerations in a real sports competition than there are. And there's a lot, you know, when it's team sports, it's exponentially more dangerous. I mean, exponentially more dangerous. I mean, think about the skeleton crew at SmackDown tonight.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there's wrestlers who, I mean, Brian was around three people, you know, the referee, Drew Gulak, and Renee Young.
Yeah.
And that's it. He could have social distanced from everybody else that whole night. You can't play a hockey game. You can't be a coach on the bench. You know, I don't know what they'll do there.
You have 20 players. I mean, it's so tough. And then, I mean, 40 players with you taking the account both teams. Like, there's no way to stay away.
And it's 300 some players when you think about the number of teams you're going to play over the course of 2, 3, 4 weeks.
Right. They're all going to be in and out of the same buildings. And,
yeah.
You know?
That's the thing. Yeah, I mean.
It's so hard. It's so hard to be able to there's just no way to eliminate risk. And that's what the issue is. There will be risk no matter what if you try to restart the league. And then the question becomes, if there's one case of coronavirus found, if there's multiple cases of coronavirus found, what is the, you know, protocol? Do you get them out of there or do you shut down the entire league at that point because you don't know how many people could possibly be infected and it could just spread and spread and spread? So I think that's the issue, is you can go jump through so many hoops. You can restart the seasons, you can get it back going, and then in the course of a day or two you could have cases of this, and then what do you just shut it down at that point? So I think that's part of the thing that's, you know, making them take so long and making them consider so many different plans as well, is that they could restart the seasons and then it could end like that. So there's just so many considerations that they kind of have to look at right now.
And, you know, baseball, I haven't followed nearly as closely as you, but I know I heard a week or so ago, you know, the idea of regionalizing the teams, regardless of American and National League. So the travel is smaller. And if you're basically only playing, if you were to only play teams in your designated region, 1/4 of the country, and there's a COVID case there, the other three could go on. But how fair is it if one person who's not very careful or unlucky shuts down a whole division? Well, the other three divisions keep playing. I mean, it's like no matter what solution you come up with, it's hard to see it as fair and equitable. And and then another issue is the teams that are going to win aren't the best teams that the GM constructed and the coaches have coached. And it's going to be the team there's going to be a much greater influence on who emerges if these leagues start up again in the NHL and NBA. One of the big factors is going to be who just stayed in shape when they weren't around their trainer and their team.
Right.
Because a lot of players are like, oh, God, I can't get back into that kind of shape again. Or do I even want to for empty crowd? It's got an asterisk next to whatever happens. It's stressful. You know, they might have family members who have had COVID. So you're going to have teams who otherwise were good. And, you know, 2-3 key players are not in shape or can't get back into shape. And that completely changes the complexion of what the trajectory was for the playoffs and the championships. So that's why it's way different with team sports than pro wrestling and NASCAR, by the way. It's a whole other challenge. So yeah, quite the story.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting. We will see, but, I don't know. It's going to be tough to have these seasons. I feel like to complete the seasons and even to start baseball back up, especially with the pushback that there's been in terms of salaries and stuff like that. So
yeah. It'll
be interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, let's go ahead and start taking some calls and some emails as we delve deeper into the show. A lot more to talk about. Charlotte was here on the program. By the way, we should just say, for those who are jumping onto the podcast and haven't kept up. Sami Zayn stripped of the IC title because he is, quote, unable to compete, somewhat cryptic. He was complaining on Twitter saying he is the true Intercontinental Champion. Have you read or heard anything more about that situation, Mike?
Really, anything that I've read or heard, I feel like has been really speculation for the most part. And it's a lot of opinion and conjecture of was WWE within its rights to do that or was it not? But I don't know, you know, and Sami Zayn's tweet to me felt like a very much in-character tweet and maybe a way, you know, a way to set up for if he or, you know, when he comes back, whoever the champion is at that point, he can challenge him, claim that he's the real Intercontinental Champion, similar to Shawn Michaels and Razor Ramon. That type of storyline. So I think that they're kind of, you know, setting the wheels in motion for that to happen at some point.
Yeah. And it's similar to the WWE Cruiserweight Championship situation right now.
Right.
They're not calling this an interim championship. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, Sami Zayn is going to consider it that. Certainly Jordan Devlin has said he considers this an imposter champion. And when he comes back, you know, he's going to go after whoever is holding the interim championship and prove he's better. In this case, you know, it's more, you know, what Roman Reigns and Daniel Bryan and so many others can say, well, I was stripped of the title, I never lost it, and therefore I'm the, you know, I really am the true champ. But it's a little more of a heel approach for Sami. But he's also got a little bit more ground to stand on, depending on how much they disclose about why he is unable to compete.
Right.
All right, let's go to phone calls. If you want to join us, all you have to do, if you've already called into the show on your phone, is push 1 on your keypad, and that'll put you in line to be on the show. If you haven't called yet and you want to be on the show, please do. The number is 347-215-8558. That's 347-215-8558. And then again, push 1 on your keypad to flag you on the switchboard so we know you want to be on the show. You can also email us, wadekellerpodcast@pwtorch.com. wadekellerpodcast@pwtorch.com. By the way, yesterday on the flagship, the Thursday flagship, Pro Wrestling Torch senior columnist going on 30 years with Pro Wrestling Torch newsletter, Bruce Mitchell joined me. We talked about Becky Lynch. We talked about Cameron Grimes getting an upset win over Finn Balor Wednesday night. That was a great topic to talk with Bruce about because Bruce has seen Cameron Grimes' career up close in North Carolina since his rookie match. And has followed his career and has touted him as a big star. So I talked with Bruce at length assessing Grimes and Balor as a centerpiece attraction in NXT. And then we had a long discussion on the Road Warriors, topical because of the Dark Side of the Ring documentary this week. Really got into a lot of details, a good supplement or standalone, but a good supplement for the documentary this week over on Vice. And it's certainly a good standalone discussion on the impact of the Warriors and their influence and many other topics. So check that out if you haven't yet. That's our Blue Logo Show. Just search Wade Keller to subscribe. All right. Up first is area code 615. 615, go ahead, state your name and where you're calling from.
Hey, guys. This is Sean and BFP, Murfreesboro, Tennessee. How y'all doing tonight?
I'm doing good, Sean. Good to hear from you as always. What'd you think of SmackDown tonight?
Well, Mike, I want to say it's the first time I've been on the phone with you, so it's good to talk to you, my friend.
Thank you. You also?
Yeah, man. I honestly wasn't a fan of the show. The one thing I will say is I did like what you guys were talking about as far as the bracket, that they did make a bracket. The only thing I didn't like about the bracket is the Bryan Gulak match was very good. But, again, I just don't like – I know it was hard to do because it was such short notice. But I just wish – I know they had – like you said, they had the storylines weaved in, but I just – I wanted some different matchups. Like, again, AJ Shinsuke, it'll be a really good match when they fight next week. But, like, they're both heels. There's no, you know, it's like, I don't know. I just like the heel babyface more. I'd rather see, you know, maybe Gulak, Shinsuke. And I know you couldn't do Daniel AJ because you wanted to have one of them advance. So you didn't want to have one of them go away, right, you know, the first round. But, you know, like, Shinsuke's most likely going to lose next week anyway. And I just would rather see some different matchups. What do you guys think about that? Like, I like that they did the bracket. And but Elias Corbin, I didn't think it was that great, and I just didn't want to see the feud. I just don't care about that feud. It just doesn't mean anything to me. And so Elias winning doesn't – I mean, I'm not invested in him. I just don't really care for him as a character, even though they worked hard, but I just didn't see the match really going anywhere, and to me it wasn't all that great.
Unless they put an Uso or a New Day member or, I mean, I guess Cesaro and Ziggler were available – that's it. Like, there's nobody else on the SmackDown roster. They already brought AJ over to add to it. It's not like there were a lot of other options. I mean, you can make the case, well, I'd rather see Ziggler against Cesaro, and that's a novel matchup between two heels, or you want to see face heel, so you can do Ziggler against Dolph and Drew against Cesaro. I thought Bryan and Drew is more intriguing than a heel face matchup. I like the novelty of the sort of quote random draw of the tournament or however it was decided, you know, storyline wise, putting those two against each other. They were rivals and then earned each other's respect. And now they're wrestling again and they've been on this journey. And now we get to see, do tempers flare or not? Is it Drew able to upset Bryan and show that he's surpassed him, or is Bryan still better? I thought there was a lot there. And I know you don't like it, Sean, and I'm not telling you should, but Elias and Corbin has had a lot of TV time. As Mike pointed out, there's a backstory just from Sunday with Elias costing Corbin the match. So it absolutely made sense if you're going to have Corbin and Elias on the roster and you're going to push them and feud them. That was a match that had a personal issue at stake, where the average casual viewer at home sitting around, they're not necessarily the type to tune into this show and download podcasts and analyze the business side and compare work rate of New Japan to Progress to whatever, pick your company, ROH. They're sitting down and there's a backstory there for them, and they can sit there and root for Elias and boo Corbin. And that is the mindset of WWE. So, I mean, I get why they did it. We can say they should deconstruct everything and build a better SmackDown and push better wrestlers and have a different ring style. But for where they are heading into this week, Elias Corbin made sense, and I will defend Drew Bryan too. Mike, your thoughts?
Yeah, you know, I certainly understand the desire to see new and unique matchups for sure. But what I will say about that is I feel like that's exactly what we're going to get in the semifinals, and we're probably going to get in the finals as well. If you just look at the way the bracket's likely going to play out, it's probably going to be matchups that either we haven't seen at all or haven't seen in a long time. So I think that's kind of WWE's line of thinking there is, we can have these first-round matchups that not only are part of the tournament, but you're furthering issues, you're furthering storylines, maybe even the case of Corbin or in Elias, maybe you could even been finishing a storyline there potentially, and you could tie that in with the tournament. And then to the point of, you know, the face-heel dynamic, normally, I agree, I would rather have a face against a heel, but in a tournament setting, I think that having a heel versus a heel or a face versus a face, it plays into the idea that it is random, that anything can happen. Just like in any tournament, in any sport, you know, you don't have heels and baby faces necessarily, or maybe, you know, sometimes a team can feel like a heel or a baby face, but, you know, anybody can play anybody just based on the draw, if it's, you know, the NCAA tournament, or, you know, how good the team is, how good the record is, if it's the NFL playoffs or whatever. And I think that the fact that they have heel versus heel and face versus face in this tournament, it makes it feel more authentic to me, and that's why I enjoy it.
Sean, what do you think of the prospects of the second round? Because you got Daniel Bryan advancing. He faces winner Jeff Hardy, Sheamus. And, I mean, Daniel Bryan and Sheamus have a history. Bryan and Hardy is another face-face matchup. It's hard to imagine with all the hype for Hardy he would lose to Sheamus early, but Sheamus, they need to be a strong heel too. I think that second round matchup is intriguing, and another reason I like these brackets going into next week.
Yeah, I do too. That's why I am curious to see where they go, and that's why the Hardy Sheamus is really intriguing, because, I mean, like I said last week, I would rather see Sheamus only because they, you know, he was gone for a while and they brought him back, and it's like, you know, why would you have him just lose all this build up, you know, all these squashes just to lose to Hardy? But I understand with Hardy, it's like, you know, there's that novelty. You know, him and Bryan would be a really fun match. But again, there's just, you know, have some history there. But again, there's just, you know, it's two guys that really like each other. There's not a lot of bad blood built in. Like, I do like matches where there's some, you know, some animosity going in to where it's like, okay, there's more like, okay, what, they're fighting for something. If they just fight and they're like, you know, they shake hands after every time, it's fine. But it gets kind of like, all right, you know, I want some, a little more intrigue. But I do like the AJ Shinsuke match. Like, I think it'll be a really good match. I think, you know, if anybody's going to get something out of Shinsuke, it's going to be AJ. I mean, he can do that. And there's, like you said, that storyline built in, which I do like. So the bracket's very intriguing. But I had two main questions that I was going to ask you about the show in general. The first was, again, with Naomi and Dana Brooke. Okay, so I understand why they're trying to push Dana. I get it. And again, I like Dana. She's a good person. I've seen her on Twitter. She's a really good person. I've heard a lot of good things about her. If you're going to try to push her, let her have a decent match. Don't just have a 2-minute random one move and then her winner is, you know, she beats Naomi, but it's just a roll up win. It's just, if you're going to push her, give her something. That's just not enough to be like, oh, you know, she beat her twice. It hurts Naomi. It hurts Dana because you're not really giving her anything in the match. What did you think about that? I just don't see where they're going with either person. It just doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, Mike, I mean, do you leave Dana and Naomi out there longer? So it seems like, you know, more of an epic battle and more of an achievement to win as opposed to kind of lucky where Naomi's like, well, okay, you caught me. And does that do as much good or does this send a message to viewers? God, Dana's on a roll right now. And, you know, it's going to make Naomi have to, you know, rethink things and her strategy if you kind of play into the storyline of everything.
Yeah, you know, it's really tough to say because the situation you get yourself in is, you know, I think Dana Brooke does have a lot of potential and, you know, natural athletic ability. But, you know, we've never really seen her have a great match. And if you have her and Naomi go for 10 minutes, do you risk exposing any weaknesses that Dana Brooke might have? And then if you do that, push is derailed before it ever gets started. So I think that's maybe a part of the consideration. And I think it feels to me like the story they're trying to tell with Dana Brooke is she's an underdog and, you know, she's now beaten Naomi, who's much more experienced and much more accomplished 2 times in a row. And then on the flip side of that, it feels to me just based on the frustration Naomi showed, maybe they're also looking to turn Naomi heel in the process as well. So I think they're trying to do multiple things here. I think by having Dana win in that fashion, it kind of plays up to that underdog role. And then I think by having Naomi lose that way, where it's like, you know, she didn't really get beat. Dana kind of got lucky. That can kind of feed into her frustration and fuel a heel turn potentially. So I think I kind of get where they're going with it. And then maybe once they accomplish what they need to accomplish, then you could flesh it out and you can allow Dana to go a little bit longer and you can let Naomi go a little bit longer in these matches and then maybe we get more out of it. But I just feel like this is kind of just the beginning of what they're trying to do with these two.
What do you think of that, Sean?
No, I see that point too, and I agree with that. To me, it just feels like a fluke win, though. Like, it doesn't feel like Dana really accomplished anything. It's just, again, it's just a roll-up. Like, there's nothing she did to be like, you have to eventually have a long match to see what you have in her. If you just get her out there for 2-minute matches, you'll never know. And you have to
That's the thing.
Out
I mean,
because
I think what you're getting at, Sean, is people, there's a big part of the fan base that wants to see that Dana can have a really good semi-lengthy match before they're going to get behind her push. And there was an opportunity here to do that in theory. Especially if, oh, I don't know, you shorten the Elias Corbin match.
Yeah, I mean, that's all I'm thinking. Like, I mean, Naomi heel is fine, but then you ruin the glow thing and everybody's into that. And so that takes that away. You can't really have a glow a heel. I mean, you could. I mean, I'm curious where they would go if they did that. But Dana, again, you know, it's nothing against her. I just want to see something more. I just feel like there's not a lot of charisma there. There's just, you know, again, her just flexing every 5 seconds to me is not charisma. There's nothing that you need to show me something. And I want to get behind her. And Mike, I'm with you. I want to get behind her, but there's got to be more meat to the bone. Like, they've got to get somewhere and there's plenty of time to get there. And so I hope they do. But the other question I was going to ask you was, other than what Charlotte came out, you know, Sasha and Bailey's been great as a heel lately. I'm really starting to enjoy her character more as a heel. I never thought I would, but I am. But again, what was the point of that segment other than, you know, putting some more of the Sasha Bailey, the kind of the, oh yeah, Sasha, you want to be her lackey type thing. But again, it's just a bunch of heels going at each other. That was the only point I took from that. Other than that, I don't see what the point of that was whatsoever. What did you guys think about that segment?
Yeah, Mike, how would you summarize what we saw? And is that, I mean, I hate to even say this, but was Charlotte supposed to be the babyface there? Or, you know, stirring things up? Because to me, Bailey came across real heelish. Charlotte, I think, was ambiguous, and that's a setback from where she had been, but now we have the Becky news. So it made me think, are they going to go a different direction with Charlotte? And then you have, Sasha kind of standing there and Charlotte being an instigator to add some fuel to the tension that feels, you know, half real and then also half overhyped by everybody making a big deal out of things, such as, you know, the end of the interview where before Sasha had a chance to answer, that they started playing the music and Sasha had no chance to answer. You can't even blame Bayley for stopping Sasha from talking when the second Charlotte stops talking, they just blast music. I thought that was so stupid production-wise because it took away, first of all, how did the person with a button on the music know that that was the end of the segment? Charlotte said something and neither Bayley, you're watching it as if it's playing out and not scripted. It was that weird moment where like, oh, I guess that was supposed to be the ending, and it made it seem really fake. So I thought that it was clunky. I thought there were some moments there where Bayley shined. Mike, your take.
Yeah, and to, you know, the point, I think that it almost was entirely meant to further the issues between Sasha and Bayley that have kind of been festering for a little while now. And honestly, I really enjoyed the segment. I thought that, I understand that like Charlotte is supposed to be a heel, but she's kind of going up against Bayley, who's a very clear heel, and they're kind of doing their back and forth thing. But at the same time, I feel with Charlotte, and this has kind of been the case for a while now, she'll play a certain role for a while, and then there are moments where she can just kind of switch and flow freely back and forth. That's just how she has felt to me. Like, obviously, lately she's been the heel because she was feuding with Rhea Ripley. But then in NXT, she had a match against Io Shirai, who's also a heel. So I think they view Charlotte as somebody who, regardless of what the situation is, they can put her in that situation and she could fill the role that needs to be filled. And, you know, I understand why they have that type of confidence in her, because I think Charlotte is absolutely a fantastic performer. I thought her promo was very good. She always has great matches. So I understand the thinking there, but I like it in the sense that, you know, if anybody knows Bayley and Sasha and knows their relationship and understands all of that, it would be, you know, in real life and from a storyline perspective, it would be Charlotte. So for Sasha to kind of hear from Charlotte what everybody at home is thinking in terms of Bayley kind of putting her into the background and using her to further her own career, I think that Charlotte saying it, you know, it makes Sasha realize it from a storyline perspective, and you can kind of play out more those issues between Sasha and Bayley, and you get to advertise a big match for next week on SmackDown, a champion versus champion match, and then Sasha's obviously going to play a role there as well. So I thought it was a really well done segment overall, and I'm looking forward to seeing what kind of role Charlotte plays in furthering this tension between Sasha and Bayley now.
Yeah, I mean, I'm different than you in the sense that I don't think if you're trying to get heel heat on Charlotte on Wednesdays and you're trying to get heel heat on Bayley on Fridays, that having Charlotte come out in a role that puts her in the babyface role is productive. Mm-hmm. I shouldn't say it's productive, because I thought Charlotte played her part well, and I thought the back and forth between them felt less scripted than a typical WWE segment. They were comfortable with each other, they're pros, and so there was a lot of good built into it in a vacuum. But my issue is you're undercutting the ultimate goal, which is to get people to want to see two people fight and root for one over the other. That is what, you know, that's why Sunday Night Football, when NBC gets to pick its game, it's not two teams that sort of get along and people don't feel really strongly about. They try to pick teams that people feel really strongly about and where people have taken strong sides. And I thought this undid that in the sense that I'm watching this, if I'm used to booing Bayley and not wanting her to succeed and thinking she's big-footing Sasha and is an egomaniac and full of herself. And then Charlotte's, I thought, been on the course for a few weeks now. Finally, she's a heel. I was celebrating. Finally, she's got a defined role, so we don't have to wait for her to come out and decide how emotionally we're supposed to feel about who she is at her core and how she's handling success. And they finally had that going on NXT. And now, because they're short on talent, they have her come out there, and we watch 10 minutes of me going, well, now I kind of like Charlotte again, because she's kind of sticking it to Bayley and pointing this stuff out. And so it just feels like there's these parallel alternate universes that offset what they're trying to do with each other. And so I'm just not a fan of that, even though you laid out, well, the positives of it. They have a match next week. Ratings are bad. Maybe they're aware of the sacrifice they're making in Charlotte's character and all the work they built for weeks, because they just think they need to show up viewership. And there is a backstory there. And they had a more realistic than usual back and forth, but I'm so philosophically opposed to this just ambiguity over who is Charlotte and how are we supposed to feel about her. And I don't like the idea that it's situational based on who she's opposite of. I don't think that works in pro wrestling. Mixed feelings on the segment. Go ahead, Mike. Yeah.
Well, no, I totally get that point. I absolutely do. Just like from my perspective, the one thing I'll say is, you know, Charlotte, yes, she was kind of the de facto face because Bayley is so clearly a heel. But at the same time, I don't think that they took away the heel edge from Charlotte in that segment, because everything that she said before Bayley came out was so arrogant. It made her look like a jerk. It played up to all the criticisms that people have of Charlotte, how she's tall and she's blonde and she's Ric Flair's daughter. And I thought that they did a good job of maintaining that. And then, you know, to the point of the Charlotte Bayley match not having a clear person to root for, I normally would agree with that, because like I said, I usually prefer the face and heel dynamic. But I think because Sasha is the added element here, people aren't necessarily going to be rooting for Charlotte or rooting for Bayley. They're going to be sitting there waiting to see what Sasha does. It's almost like they're going to be rooting for Sasha to see the light and to turn on Bayley. So I feel like because of her involvement, I feel like it's a little different than a heel versus heel match normally would be.
Yeah, no, good counterpoint. I will say, the fact that Charlotte cut that arrogant promo, I'm surprised there's not a picture of me up on the wall at the Performance Center, because I inspire everybody and bragging about herself being a superior athlete and 5'10 and blonde and my last name's Flair. You can make the argument, yeah, she so established herself as a heel in some people's eyes that actually worked to make Bayley more sympathetic when Charlotte and Bayley were going at it. Your argument is they're both unlikable. Neither of them, for most people, came across at all sympathetic. And Sasha had to stand there and look at two, you know, people who fans don't like, who viewers don't like, go at it. And next week, it actually elevates her ultimately on this journey as the babyface, because who would want to choose between Bayley and Charlotte?
Right. That's just my perspective, but I can absolutely see the other side of it too. It's just kind of whatever your preference is, I guess. Well,
go ahead, Sean.
Well, I was going to say, that's the thing about – now, the thing I was thinking about too when you guys were talking is next week, that's the thing. Like, Sasha would have to do – Sasha might not do anything next week. I mean, she might just help Bayley just to prolong the storyline. So, to me, like, if they do that, it doesn't – it hurts even worse, because – if you're trying to get Charlotte, you know, to talk to Sasha to get, you know, more against Bayley, it's like, still, like you said, Wade, the main thing about this is I haven't liked Charlotte, you know, for a while, like the way they portrayed her for a long, long time. I just think they go back and forth too many times. Charlotte is a better heel, clearly. Like, she's not a good baby face at all. There's nothing that we've ever seen that makes me think, oh, I want to get behind Charlotte. She's nasty. She feels like she's better than everybody else. That's a pure heel, and so they would have to do something with Sasha. Sasha would have to make a move next week, and I don't know if they're going to do that, because I think they want to prolong the Sasha Bayley story and to make you get more excited about her turning on Bayley. So, like, I don't know. I wasn't a fan of the segment. Wait, I was more in your camp. I just didn't care for it. They need to keep Charlotte heel for a long, long time. I don't like the back and forth. It doesn't make me like her anymore or make me get behind her anymore, and I don't think that's what they're trying to do, but it sure felt like that, like you said, watching that. It was like, I kind of like Charlotte now. Like, she's going at Bayley and talking sense to Sasha. So, I mean,
which is a credit to Bayley, by the way, that you would watch Charlotte and go, God, I'm siding with Charlotte here, because Bayley has risen as a heel promo lately.
Yeah, I really like, you know, and like I said, I never thought I would like Bayley as a heel. I just thought, you know, it ruined her, which I thought they did at the time. But now it's like they've kind of got her in a lane, and she's being so, just the way she talks and during the matches, I have really enjoyed that. One quick question I'll let you get to the next caller is what did you think about the Miz TV segment in general? Because I like that they put the stuff with Otis's mom in there and a little bit of the family. So I like that they kind of made it a little more real. But gosh, like, Otis is just so funny, and I like the comedy aspect of him, but I feel like there's got to be some kind of a serious, and do you think they're leading to something next week where they go into his character a little bit more and dig a little deeper? What did you guys think about that? And thank you for taking my call, guys, as always. I really appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks, Sean. Appreciate it. Thanks for being a VIP member. Mike, should Otis change, or was that an appropriate and fulfilling kind of celebration moment for Otis after the upset Money in the Bank win?
Yeah, you know, I felt, to me, it felt like they were kind of laying the groundwork a little bit to add some layers, which I understand. And Otis as a comedy character, as that mid-card comedic act, I think is fantastic. And it's part of the reason why I'm, you know, a little bit reluctant, you know, when he won Money in the Bank to see where they go with it. But there's so many things that could happen in terms of like, him losing the briefcase to somebody, or Mandy Rose maybe manipulating him because she came across as very devious in some ways, just the way she was looking and acting, it felt to me. So I think there's going to be story told there. But as far as the Miz TV segment goes, it felt like they were trying to maintain his comedic side while also telling a little bit more about him, about his childhood, about his background as an amateur wrestler, you know, and trying to make him likable, which he already is, but even more so on a real level, rather than just this guy's funny and I like him because he's funny, but also because he went through adversity when he was growing up, and he, you know, scratched and clawed and got to this point. And if you're really trying to make Otis feel like he is a threat to be Universal Champion, and you're really trying to make people believe that he can and will be a main eventer, then he does have to be more than just the ha-ha funny stuff. He has to have a story. You have to have a reason to really, really get behind him and really, really like him. And I think that's what they're trying to do here. I think it was just the start, because you just kind of learned a little bit. And I think that over the coming weeks, we'll probably delve more and more into his actual history and kind of more of who he is as a real person, rather than just Otis, the wrestling character. And I think that could maybe help in terms of making him feel like a more legitimate threat.
And they, you know, and I don't know how legitimate a threat they ultimately want to make him.
Right.
I
do agree with that. I think that, again, I don't think he's going to be world champion by the end of this, but yeah. I think they want to make people believe he could be.
Yeah, no. And I think that's prudent. You don't want a complete joke of a Money in the Bank winner. I thought they took some steps towards humanizing him. I mean, showing him as a kid, showing him flexing his arms, you know, and being with his mom, talking about having a learning disability and how school was confusing. I think that's going to bond him with a lot of people. People are going to relate to that. Everybody has either gone through that or knows someone who has. And he said, you know, my mom really helped me get through school so that I could be in sports, especially wrestling. There's a magic word. He said that he's not just, this whatever people perceived him as, kind of a joke of an athlete. He was a wrestler when he was a kid. Like, this has been a course that he's been on. If you play into the idea that professional wrestling is the ultimate path for anyone who wrestles in school, he has achieved his dream, and now he's got a chance to be Universal Champion. I thought they actually humanized him more than I expected they would this week. And it can, depending on how long he has a briefcase, it can be a journey that adds more elements to him. I thought it was like having Miz and Morrison in the opening segment antagonize him and challenge him to a match. And it's like, well, Tucker's not here. And they're like, well, you know, then go find a partner. The idea that then he couldn't find anyone who would say yes, but he, you know, ask Braun, and Braun should come to his defense. Braun's a baby face. Mm-hmm. Otis is a good guy. Miz and Morrison are awful human beings. Braun should relish the opportunity to team with good old Otis and beat up Miz and Morrison. So of course he'd say yes. And then there's that moment of, but wait a second, are you doing this just to get me in a vulnerable position to cash in the Money in the Bank? I know how this goes. I thought it was like actually relatively a logical path to take the week of the Money in the Bank to introduce a somewhat awkward situation where the Money in the Bank holder's teaming with the champion that he, in theory, is going to cash in against. If Braun holds that title long enough and Otis doesn't cash it in, or doesn't cash it in some other way, or lose it, or whatever, who knows, it's Otis. You know, that's a path people assume they're heading on, and so that's a hook. You know, who's going to be will Braun ultimately agree? They left that hanging. And then if he does, is Otis going to try to cash in on him? And then they teased it. So, I mean, for what they had to work with and the storylines coming into the show, I actually thought that the bookend segments made a lot of sense and played into the obvious storyline points that you would want them to do. And I thought they, with Miz and Morrison as the antagonists and the journey they put Otis on and the little teaser at the end, I thought it was well done.
I agree. I thought it was a well-told story. And like I kind of mentioned a little bit before, I think that they also showed us like a different side of Mandy as well. And I think that adds to the story too. It almost felt like she was manipulating Otis a little bit, telling him, you know, okay, if Sheamus won't be your partner, why don't you ask Braun Strowman? And then she comes out at the end and kind of distracts Braun Strowman with her music. And it almost feels like she's kind of trying to point Otis in the direction of why don't you cash in on this guy and trying to put him in that position, because the story that they tell with Otis all the time is like, you know, he's not necessarily the brightest bulb and maybe he won't. And Corey Graves even said it. Does this guy even realize what he has here? Is he even going to know to cash in? They're almost like playing it up like, Mandy is the brains behind this operation and is trying to kind of control Otis. So I think that's a story that's going to play out over the next several weeks and months as well.
All right, let's go to our next call here. 305, go ahead, state your name and where you're calling from.
Hey, Mike. Hey, Wade. It's Javier from Miami. How's it going?
Good. Good to hear from you, Javier. What did you think of SmackDown? We've talked about a lot of things so far, not everything yet. Curious what your take is.
I think it was better than meh, so that's a good thing.
Yeah.
A bunch of things it also helped that I had fallen behind, so I fast-forwarded the entire Corbin Elias match. So would you recommend I go back and watch it?
Sure, yeah. Yeah. Well,
most people wouldn't, but we don't really have an issue with it.
I was a bit worried when I saw it was going on for like ever. And I'm like, I don't know if, you know, these two guys, I mean, I don't hate them. I'm not part of the quote unquote hater club for them. But, you know, when I saw it was going that long, I'm like, oh man, I don't know. I'll go back and watch it. But yeah, I mean, it as a result, it kind of felt like a breezy episode. So, one of the things you already talked about, but what I liked, you kind of mentioned the Brian cutting off the fiery promo. I really like the fact that it almost seems, and particularly with what they were talking about in commentary, that it almost seems like they're trying to position the belt as the work rate belt, you know, where back in the day, whoever had the IC belt was pretty much the best wrestler in the company. So I kind of dug that and the fact that he got to use the word wrestler too. So it looks like that word's out of storage.
It's sad that it's something we celebrate.
I feel like we've been hearing it a lot lately, even before tonight. They've been saying it a lot. So,
yeah, I mean, because I even wrote it here that because it was Randy Orton and Daniel Bryan, and they're giving more carte blanche to do whatever they want. But the fact that Otis said it was more telling, because I forgot that he had said it. But yeah, it looks like that word's come out of retirement. So, I do like the idea of the IC belt being representative of the best wrestler or the highest work rate wrestler, that sort of thing. Now, do you think I should be getting my hopes up for Brian Shinsuke?
No.
I think it's going to be Brian Styles. I feel like it's going to be probably.
I think Shinsuke's been defined down enough. And it would feel a little too familiar. I think Styles coming over from Raw and not making it to the finals feels like that would really hurt Styles, you know, tucking his tail between his legs, heading back to Raw. I think if you're going to bring Styles over, unless you run a major angle of some kind that explains it, major is maybe overstating it, but a significant explanation for why Styles came up short with some external factor or him blowing it because he was distracted by something else, like being obsessed with Otis having his briefcase or something. There might be some other story that they want to tell, but I don't think he can just not make it to the finals without there being something to explain it. So, yeah, I mean, when we look at the brackets, I mean, it's possible Sheamus or Jeff Hardy advanced to the finals. I wouldn't rule that out, and it could be a Jeff Hardy, AJ Styles finals. I think of the Styles Nakamura match, again, barring some sort of outside factor, Styles has to win. And then Elias King Corbin, I think, I think the right guy won that because of the double heel matchup, you know, was almost a given. So, yeah, I don't think I would rework it. I'm just intrigued of how Hardy and Sheamus is portrayed. You know, there's a chance Sheamus just gets DQ'd for being, you know, brutalizing Jeff Hardy at the beginning of the match, and then that sets up kind of a what should be a dream match, not a dream match, you know, a nice face-to-face matchup with Jeff Hardy and Bryan, but Hardy is hobbled and Bryan wins, although that's kind of a weak way to go to the final. So, yeah, I think there's different stories they can tell. Mike, what's your most likely path that you think to the finals in both brackets at this point?
Yeah, I think that, to me, I feel like it's pretty clear that they would want to go Bryan Styles. They had the interaction in the Money in the Bank match, and they keep replaying that over and over again where they battle into Vince's office. And they have history as well because Bryan turned heel on Styles to win the WWE Championship. So that's the most star power I feel like you could have for the finals. You know, as far as Hardy Sheamus goes, I think Hardy wins that. And then I feel like maybe Sheamus costs Jeff Hardy in the next round. Or, like you said, maybe beats him up like beforehand and really weakens him to some degree so that, you know, Sheamus doesn't come out of it looking too weak. I don't think Elias is really going to be a factor here. So I definitely think Styles and Bryan, with Bryan winning, would be my prediction right now, I think.
Javier, back to you.
Yeah, that was just a pie in the sky hope for me.
In the best case scenario, good scenario.
Yeah, and I mean, and it also, because I was hoping that it'd bring something out of Shinsuke, and particularly since he's also fighting AJ Styles, if we get like a great back-to-back Shinsuke matches between Styles and Bryan, that would be my secret hope. Although I'm not, you know, I'm not really expecting that. I did want to mention real quick the caterpillar from Strowman was probably the worst thing I've seen this week. And I
oh my god, no, and that was the best thing. You have that all wrong, Javier. That was the best thing you saw a week, is Braun trying to do a caterpillar right next to Otis, who has it down, and it was the most awful thing you can imagine. But it was so bad that it was, you know, like camp good. But I mean, it depends on how you look at it. Mike, what do you think? Break the tie.
I had a bigger issue with just the overall sloppiness of him in that match in general. I'm not a Braun guy, so I'm going to side with Javier, I believe.
Cool. All right.
I thought it was so bad that thanks to the fix, I think it's the worst thing I saw. But thanks to the fix, I actually looked up the Gabriel Benitez leg injury this week. And yeah, that was a pretty rough landing on that caterpillar. Overall, what do you guys make of all, after not really getting any tournaments in a long time, all of a sudden we've got tournaments for the NXT Cruiserweight title, the TNT title, Impact's running a tournament. I mean, you know, some people call this the empty arena, but I'm thinking that we should name it to the and that with the Intercontinental, change it to the tournament era.
Well, I think part of it is it's just tougher without crowds to create new feuds and new storylines. You just don't have that crowd interaction, and I think they're trying to. I mean, it might not be a strategy they can engage in for another year, but I think they're trying to kick the can down the road a little bit in terms of going to some of their more the feuds that they think will have more fan heat and be more intense and higher end. And so a way to fill TV time is tournaments. It gives you a structure to why matches are happening, and it gives you a chance to have a novel matchups that you don't have a reason to have otherwise. And that's a challenge when you don't have a live crowd and you have a skeleton crew you're working with. What's the reason these people are even wrestling each other? And a tournament gives you that sort of built-in structure. So in a way, it's kind of a crutch, and I think that's absolutely the rationale behind AEW doing it, and it was the impetus. And then there's the side effect of for NXT is having these matches. Although it does with NXT, it feels a lot less central to what they're doing than the because of the level of star power compared to AEW's TNT Championship. But I mean, I do think this era will be remembered for tournaments, especially now with the IC title dominating SmackDown now for a couple weeks leading into Backlash. Mike.
It's really born from necessity, but I think it's a good thing. You know, like you said, on NXT for the past few weeks, you've had two tournament matches per show, and you're filling a lot of time there. For the next few weeks on SmackDown, you're going to have two tournament matches per show, and you're going to fill a lot of time there. And it's kind of a known thing that Vince doesn't like tournaments. It's really why the King of the Ring tournament went by the wayside, and then it kind of would – one year it would happen and then it wouldn't, and it was kind of back and forth. It's just not really his thing, but I think that even he realizes, you know, it's just, it's not easy to fill this time, given the situation that we're in, but I think tournaments are just such a good way to do it. I think most fans, I know I do, really enjoy tournaments. They enjoy the unpredictability of it. They enjoy looking at a bracket and filling out a bracket like it's the NCAA tournament. Like, it's just a thing that sports fans and wrestling fans enjoy. And I think that it's been good for all the products involved that they're having these tournaments. I think it just makes for a more compelling and more interesting show.
Javier, anything else? I agree with you on that too.
Well, yeah, I'm officially all in on Sonya Deville.
Yeah.
Nothing you could do is
bad
at this point.
Wow.
You know, I mean, best part was the fact that she kept Dolph Ziggler from speaking at all. So that's.
Oh, I love Dolph.
I love that. I mean, because she looks like she's crazy, but it's like barely controlled crazy.
Yeah.
You know, so that pitch perfect stuff that she's doing. I think she's been one of my favorite acts so far.
Yeah, I mean, she's in contention for a better promo than Daniel Bryan. I mean, it was heelish. It didn't come across as like cheap heat. It came across as I've got these are my genuine feelings about you, Mandy Rose, and I'm going to just lay it out there and not filter it. It's like a unfiltered domestic argument between two people who are just letting go with their grievances, or two really good friends going at it who are ex-friends or roommates or whatever. I think people can relate to participating in or overhearing moments like that with family and friends. And I thought Sonya tapped into that in a way that most wrestlers don't, and it felt less scripted and more genuine. And she is the surprise of the year, surprise of the season, in that she has emerged from, and I think everybody sees it. I mean, I don't think this is like some novel outlying point of view that you're expressing or that I am. I think people look at her in a different way now, and for her to just sort of hover as long as she did, not getting a chance to show this, she's suddenly become someone that you actually want to, like, if you're Vince McMahon, protect and take into consideration going forward in the women's division. Mike, your thoughts?
Yeah, she's been fantastic. She's a true breakout star. And even over just the past few weeks, it hasn't taken long for this to come out and for just her to take it to that next level. Like, this week was great. This is probably her best promo and her best moment. Just the passion, the emotion that she displayed in it. It felt so real and so raw, but it wasn't the start of this. Like, she's been doing, she cut a great promo previously on Mandy Rose. Even like the way that she interrupted her match against Carmella, normally when somebody interrupts a match to distract that somebody, it's like, this really wouldn't be distracting at all. Why would you even pay attention to it? Just have the match. It was legitimately distracting, but at the same time, she was making good points and being entertaining. And then in the match against Mandy Rose, like, I love when, you know, the wrestlers talk trash in the ring. And I think that's been one of the things that has been good to come out of the no fan shows, is more talking in the ring and getting to feel like you're in that match. Everybody can do it well. Sonya Deville did it expertly. I felt like her trash talk during that Mandy Rose match was so good. She's just firing on all cylinders. Everything she's been doing over the past few weeks has been great. And again, like, they have to keep building this momentum, and they have to capitalize on this momentum, because she feels like she could be a massive, massive star in the women's division.
Javier, anything else you want to add?
No, I just wanted to let you know, Wade, that I wanted to use the word reticent in a sentence today, but after listening to Fix this week, you know, I'm a little bit apprehensive.
Oh, you're very you walked right up to that line. All right. Thanks, Javier. Well done. Well done.
You'd enjoy the wordplay.
Yes. The Fix with Todd Martin, which I host with Todd every week, is a staple of VIP membership. And if you're not a VIP member, you're missing out, because it's a lot of fun, but it's a lot of fun combined with just great top shelf analysis from Todd. If you haven't heard Todd talk about current events and answer mailbag questions on a weekly basis, and you're a hardcore wrestling fan, you are missing out. So go VIP, pwtorch.com/goVIP. You'll know what I mean when you just download it and listen for a couple straight weeks. You'll be hooked. Javier, do you agree with that?
Real quick, wait on the fix.
Yeah.
You made me flip off a person because I was in my car and I heard a car honking and I thought it was someone behind me.
Oh, that's hilarious. Yeah, the window's open in the podcast studio, and there's this cute toddler outside and wandering around, and people were like a couple times driving by and honking and going, hi, you know, waving goodbye to this cute toddler. And so it made it out of the podcast. So yeah, Javier was like, apparently flipping out because he thought someone was honking at him.
Yeah, I heard it was someone behind me because, you know, the light had just changed. And here,
yep.
A few weeks ago, we talked about the driving in Miami. The light had just changed, and I hear,
yeah.
I'm like, dude, what the hell?
That's hilarious.
So, yeah. All right, guys. Have a good night.
Awesome. Thanks, Javier. It's like if you're listening, you know, there's a siren in a background on something you're listening to in the car radio, and you're like, oh, no, what's going on? And it's like, oh, yeah, that was on the radio. Or that's the song.
One of my co-hosts on Ring Rust Radio lives in New York City, so it's constant jackhammering and a car honking, and you never know what you're going to hear.
Yeah. that's fun. All right. If you want to be on the show as a caller, push 1 on your keypad or give us a call, 347-215-8558. I want to hit a mailbag question on Sonia here first. Chris B. in Long Island, speaking in New York. Long Island, a little calmer than Manhattan.
Yeah.
Hi, Wade. I really enjoyed Sonia's promo on Mandy tonight. She reminded me of Mickey James back when Mickey was feuding with Trish. And I like that she was playing the bitter ex-best friend. And yet she had valid points. As you can tell, Sonia has impressed me lately, including tonight. Do you think she has what it takes to be a breakout star? WWE can certainly use more like her to fill the huge void left by Becky's departure. Would love to know your thoughts. I've been VIP for a while now, and it's just been awesome to get more of your audio and insights, especially now while working from home. Go VIP. Great endorsement, Chris. Thank you for your words of support. PWTorch.com/goVIP. I mentioned this before. We're a small business. The ad market's way down across the board on the website and podcast world. So we are leaning on memberships more. So if you enjoy what we do and you're a pro wrestling fan and you also want to support a small business during these times, it's an expenditure I think you can feel proud of, and I think you'll get a lot back in return by going VIP if you haven't yet or if you join us again. I was just listening to Bruce Mitchell mailbag with Zach Cadorn today on a bike ride, and the in-depth discussion of Mark Henry's career was fantastic. And I mean, it was, I don't know, 20 some minutes of Bruce just elaborating on the tough things Mark Henry had to put up with in terms of some racial stereotyping and nicknames and the whole backstory of why he got hired in the first place and what the intended course was and some changes in that. And then he moved to a discussion on the NWA World Championship and why there were heel champions in some territories in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and why there were a different kind of champion, babyface heel, and the type of champion in other territories, including the WWF. It just was a history lesson. It's fascinating. And I just encourage you guys to check it out. It's really next level analysis when you go VIP with a great team at PW Torch VIP. So check it out, pwtorch.com/goVIP. Rates start at $9.99 a month or subscribe for a year. And the average comes down to $8.25. And I know some of you have been subscribing as a show support in these times as a way to acknowledge times are tough for the ad market and a lot of small businesses. So sincere thanks to those of you who are doing that. And I hope you stick around because you just enjoy the content and you find it worth the monthly fee. And I know a lot of you can't afford it. And I truly appreciate you downloading the shows and listening and supporting us in other ways. All right. So with that sidebar out of the way, Mike, the upside of Sonya Deville is an interesting question, because a point that speaking of Todd Martin that he's made is WWE is not very good at elevating wrestlers once they come in and they're at a certain level. And I'm curious if you can come up with somebody who was around as long as Sonya has been around, or, you know, somewhere along that much time, and then had a breakout moment or a feud, and all of a sudden Vince looked at him or her differently, and it led to a clear raising of their position on the card that worked and was sustained.
You know what? I think maybe Becky Lynch fits into that category. I feel like, you know, she came into to the main roster with some fanfare because she came up with, Charlotte and with Sasha Banks, and that was really significant when they all came up together. And she was in that triple threat match when they switched the Divas Championship to the Women's Championship at WrestleMania 32. And she was in some high-profile positions. But I think that, you know, most people would agree that her talent level was not matching up with where they were positioning her. She wasn't getting sustained runs for a long time. She was the first SmackDown Women's Champion, but for a long time on SmackDown after that, it just felt like she was an afterthought. You know, they were pushing Charlotte, and they were pushing Alexa Bliss, and they were pushing any number of other women. And she was kind of lost in the shuffle to some degree. But then once that heel turn happened, but it really wasn't a heel turn because everybody supported her, but once that happened at SummerSlam a couple years ago, you know, people were just firmly behind her. And I think that was kind of a turning point for her. Again, I think Becky was in more high profile positions earlier in her career than Sonya has been to this point. So it's not a like for like comparison, but I think there are parallels there. So I think that now maybe this feud and these promos and these moments are going to be like that quote unquote heel turn for Becky Lynch, where Vince sees this and understands that this could be a potential huge moneymaker. Like, I really think that maybe Sonya has the potential of a Becky Lynch. And I know that's a lot to say because Becky Lynch has been pushed as maybe the biggest woman star in the history of WWE. But, I mean, Sonya Deville has cut some incredible promos just like Becky Lynch has. And she has a legitimate background as well, which helps her too in MMA. So, you know, she has that credibility, that instant credibility that you need. And she's playing a great heel right now, but she really is a likable person as well. And I have no doubt that she could be kind of that edgy baby face at some point that Becky Lynch is right now. So I think Sonya Deville, absolutely, she has that level of potential. And I just hope that WWE is realizing it. And, you know, I know that they don't always make the best decisions, but I don't know how they wouldn't realize it, because everybody that, you know, watches the product, I feel like sees it right now that she is breaking out in a big way.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm intrigued with what they do with her. I'm a little worried that we're noticing something, and Vince is going to go back to his old ways. But if Becky, if Becky's story can, I mean, I think Becky's a good example, you know, and you know, Daniel Bryan, they fought tooth and nail when fans got behind him, pushing him. And it's such a just absurd, ridiculous rewriting of history to even entertain the notion that Becky and Bryan were better off because management fought against them, and that's what caused fans to like them even more. That cost the company so much money and so many lost months when the authority were demeaning Bryan and pointing out things that were whispered behind the scenes about him, why they couldn't push him. And they did it because they were trying to destroy him. And then when it didn't work, they rewrote history. And we're like, see how well that worked? We got Bryan over even more with our heel tactics. And it's complete BS. They didn't want it to work, and when it did, they took credit for it working. And that happened with Brian James and Becky Lynch too, on Twitter. Absolute bunk. So it's just my side rant, because I hear people who should know better giving credence to that just utter ridiculous rewriting of history. They didn't want Brian to get over. It wasn't a strategy to get him over. It was a strategy so that they would destroy him enough that they could have him back at the level he thought he should be at, and they wouldn't have to feel guilty because fans would be less enthusiastic about him. And the same thing with Becky, because she was getting in the way of Charlotte and what they thought was right for her. So now those things are not working against Sonya. The thing working against Sonya Deville is just if Vince is paying attention to the quality of what she's doing. Is he sitting back watching these shows and are people telling him, yeah, this is really good? And then, or does he have reasons to think nobody will ever accept her at that level? Cause you know, there was a reason I had her slotted at the point that I did for so long, and I don't want to be wrong. I hope he's big enough and open-minded enough to say, there's something here. Let's figure out what her ceiling is by giving her every opportunity now to land in a higher place.
And I feel like there's a couple things maybe working in her favor at this point too. Like, she's getting over as a heel, and you know, getting over is a relative term when there's no crowd, but getting over in terms of people realizing how good she is, which wasn't, you know, Daniel Bryan did play heel before, you know, his big babyface run, but he was always kind of beloved, and Becky was always kind of beloved. And I wouldn't say that's always been the case with Sonya. So, you know, maybe it's a different perspective that they're going to in a different lens they're going to look through. And also the fact that there is no crowd. So, you know, it can't be a situation where everybody's cheering Sonya Deville, and because that's not who they want to be cheered, they kind of lash out against it and then push her down the card. That situation isn't there. It's all just, you know, no fans there. So Vince and whoever else it has input in these decisions are watching her and seeing everything that she's doing, you know, in this, you know, this type of environment. So it just comes down to if they are realizing how good she is. And I think that honestly, the lack of fans being there, it might be in a strange way better for Sonya in terms of them realizing how good she is and realizing what they have on their hands. Because again, I think, as you said, the fan reaction, while hugely positive for the Becky Lynch's and the Daniel Bryan's, almost worked against them in a way as well.
Yes. Yes. All right. Let's go to our next email here. But yeah, good points, Chris, and definitely good talking points. I am surprised that I am as intrigued as I am about where things go from here. Dave from Pittsburgh says, when I saw Charlotte come out, I was not happy. This felt like WWE pushing someone on us again, but I was surprised how well the promo with her and Bayley and Sasha went, including the part where Bayley said she beat everyone and Sasha gave a subtle look. How well everyone interacted was really refreshing, and it felt real and not overscripted. And I did get that feeling during the promo. Like I, you know, sometimes you just watch and you're like, oh my God, they're taking turns and reciting something they memorized, but their mind is already on what they're doing after the show because they spent all day trying to memorize these lines and it doesn't feel authentic to them. This felt authentic. It felt like two people going at it. And so that was good. And the Sasha and her subtle reactions, it's reminiscent of Batista and Evolution, where there was those, you like, yes, Triple H is talking or Ric Flair's talking, but Batista catches your eye and it's like, how's he reacting? And Sasha's been doing that. And that's why, by the way, I didn't like, I don't want to harp on this too much, but I didn't like that something that felt authentic and not pre-planned ended with this clearly pre-planned moment, which is hit the music because Charlotte finished the last line in the script. And it didn't feel like a natural ending to the segment because Bayley, like, if Sasha was about to speak and then Bayley said, I've heard enough of you, Charlotte, let's get out of here. Then cue Charlotte's music.
Right.
That feels natural. And that isn't that hard. If you do this for a living and you watch back your shows and the goal, I mean, I say this all the time, wrestlers work really hard to make punches look real. They work really hard to make suplexes look like they hurt. They execute them crisply. They sell them. Why can't the people on the production side work equally hard to make promos seem real and authentic instead of fake? And it's not, I'm not patting myself on the back for this genius thought that after Charlotte got done talking, Sasha should have been ready to speak up and Bayley should have maybe been aware of it, but we're not 100% sure, but we're highly suspicious that she said, I'm tired of you talking, Charlotte. We've heard enough. This is my show. Get out of my ring. No, I'm getting out of my ring. I don't want to be in here with you anymore. And then Sasha can be upset she didn't have a chance to talk. Boom, Charlotte's music plays. You have a segment that ends in a way that doesn't feel like it's on cue because it's part of the script. And that bugged me, and I don't want them to be lazy like that and just go through the motions as some robot coding things. And so that's my rant, and I wish it – and it left a sour taste in my mouth because – I did think, even though I disagreed with putting Charlotte in that position, as I expressed earlier, and having fans kind of choose and all that, Sasha had a chance there. She had multiple chances during that promo to kind of show her approach to this. It's sort of like you say, Mike, a third wheel, and fans are waiting for it to explode. A little Ms. Dow-esque, too, by the way. And I think the payoff is going to be good and better than some of the moments in the build on the production side.
Yeah, and the production thing that you mentioned, it's a subtle thing, and I don't know that everybody watching would even pick up on that, but as you lay it out, it certainly makes a lot of sense, if for no other reason than if Bayley does that and cuts off Sasha Banks, it just plays into it even more. It makes Bayley look even more like a jerk and makes Sasha look even more like she's just kind of like this afterthought behind Bayley. So I think it would have added to the segment, certainly. But also to your point about Sasha being kind of similar to Batista, 100% agree. And I've been saying that for quite a while now. It's kind of why I wished that Sasha Banks would have been in Money in the Bank and won Money in the Bank, because it would have been like when Batista won the Royal Rumble and, you know, Triple H thought for sure he was going to go challenge for the other title, but Batista knew all along what he was really going to do, and they kind of played up to that. So you don't have that factor here with Sasha, but it's very obvious to everybody watching at home that Sasha's having reservations and that ultimately she is going to turn on Bayley. But within the storyline, it's not somehow not obvious to Bailey. And I think that's part of what makes it a good story is that, you know, she's so wrapped up. She's so caught up in herself and everything having to do with herself. And she's so selfish that she doesn't stand that right around the corner, her best friend is going to be turning on her at any moment.
Yep. And and there's really good aspects of this story. And from a Bailey-Sasha storyline that got off to a rough start but had high hopes, I think they got this on track.
Yeah.
And so there's some good there. And Sasha was sort of lost. And with Becky gone, it does open up a top babyface slot. And I think Asuka's too, I wouldn't say damaged, but I think she's sort of now a character actor, not a lead. Mm-hmm. And based on how she's been portrayed, and that's probably her destiny anyway. I hate to break it to WWE fans, but somebody who doesn't speak really good English is not likely to be the centerpiece lead babyface in a Vince McMahon run Raw or SmackDown production, because that's not the type of pro wrestling Vince McMahon promotes. It's just the reality. You can lament it, but the reality is he's just not going to sacrifice the top lead babyface female position to somebody who can't carry television segments like we just saw Charlotte and Bayley and Sasha do. That's the business he's in, is what we saw tonight, not Asuka trying to work her way through a babyface promo or a heel promo for that matter, like she did in NXT. So that said, if you've got everything going on with NXT and they've got their own crew, you've got a lead babyface opening on Raw right now that wasn't there as of a week ago. And even SmackDown, you know, it's an opportunity. If Dana Brooke can rise to the occasion, that's great. Otherwise you're looking at Lacey Evans as the one who has a chance to seize that too. So there's some spots to be grabbed in a, you know, reach for that brass ring, as Vince McMahon would encourage you to do, but you have to be the right person to do it, or, you know, it doesn't work, but that's a whole other thing.
Well, I think Sasha can do it. And I think that I certainly think that of anybody, any woman on the roster right now, I think Sasha is the most obvious candidate to fill that spot, that void left by Becky, because she's kind of been in that spot before to a degree. And she's got that edge to her where she can be a babyface but still have that edge, just like Becky Lynch did. I think it's a perfect fit. I think that's probably the direction they'll go. And I think that the best thing would be, once Sasha and Bayley have their feud, hopefully you're at a point where you can do a superstar shakeup or a draft or whatever and separate them and get them on different brands, so that Sasha can kind of rise as the top babyface on whatever brand she's on, and then Bayley can continue to establish herself as a top heel on whatever brand she's on.
All right, let's go to JB from Detroit. I had two creative thoughts on what Otis might do with his Money in the Bank briefcase. One, cash in for a tag team title shot with Tucker, or cash in for Mandy to get a SmackDown women's title shot against Bayley. I personally wouldn't be a fan of this, as I think it would really devalue Money in the Bank and turn it into what is almost a comedy spot. I do admit, if crowds were in attendance, both options would probably get a huge pop. What are your thoughts? Go VIP, 4 exclamation marks, for the best content in the world. Well, thank you, JB. I have to say this again, pwtorch.com/goVIP to become a member. If you take these endorsements from other members seriously, check us out. I Otis cashing in against Mandy, on behalf of Mandy, I hadn't thought of. There's a CBS Survivor moment of handing over the immunity idol. And having it completely backfire.
Yep.
And that has happened. Where's Johnny Fairplay when you need him to tell me exactly what season? But there is that moment where Otis could cash in and Mandy, you know, I mean, who knows? I mean, it could go a lot of different directions. It could be a sweet moment. It could be a heartbreaking moment. Yeah, I mean, Otis is like, the only thing that made me prouder than winning Money in the Bank is winning the heart of Mandy Rose. And I mean, his focus is on her. I could absolutely see his character running out when, like, even next week. I mean, I don't think they'll do it this soon, but Charlotte's got Bailey, you know, whatever they do with Charlotte and Bailey. And then, but Bailey's hurt, down and out, and Otis runs out and calls Mandy to the ring, and Mandy's like, what? And Otis then runs up to the referee and hands the briefcase, and, you know, Cole and Grace can play dumb and go, Otis, you can't win the women's title. That's not, you're supposed to cash in against Braun. And then the ref goes to the ring announcer, ringside, and the ring announcer goes, Otis has cashed in on behalf of Mandy Rose. And Cole goes, is this legal? And Grace is like, I don't care. This is hilarious. I mean, I could totally imagine WWE doing that. So, and then, it, you know, whatever happens, happens. So, yeah, I thought Otis cashing in against The Fiend or Bray Wyatt feels like that's got to be a little bit down. It's got to be a ways down the road. Otis cashing in against heel Braun is an option if they want to turn Braun heel. I don't think we really saw hints of that. I thought Braun was actually super cool with Otis with a little fist bump after Otis was thinking of cashing in. I was kind of curious how Braun would respond, and he responded, I thought, largely going, I believe you, and I also don't see you as a big threat, so I'm going to forgive you, but not in a way that felt condescending. So anyway, yeah, your thoughts on any of that, Mike?
Yeah, you know, I certainly don't want and don't think he's going to cash in for a tag team title shot. It feels right. Almost like Tucker's kind of been thrown to the wayside at this point. But the point made about Mandy Rose is a really interesting one, and like you, I hadn't thought about it, but it certainly is something to think about, because, you know, it would play up perfectly to the character of Otis and how all he really cares about is Mandy, and then Mandy is maybe kind of manipulating him into this. But I will say, like, it could be done, but really, does it really fit? Like, can you technically do that? I don't know. Like, they can write the script and write the story any way they want to write it. Yeah. But at the same time, like, he won the men's Money in the Bank ladder match for a title shot for himself. So technically, can he do that for Mandy?
Well,
I don't know.
Asuka isn't walking around with a briefcase. So she,
right.
She's got, like, in a way you could say, well, normally we would allow it, but since Asuka won the belt and not actually a contract, that contract is sort of out there in this other world. And it didn't, you know, there's not a women's one that is available to be cashed in. So they could actually, under these circumstances, create a little bit of a reason for it. And I mean, my God, I mean, New Day are a 3-man team, pick two of them. You have a tag team titles changing as in singles matches. I mean, there's what other exceptions are there, Mike? I mean, there's plenty. So
I think it's possible. And I honestly don't hate the idea at all. I think that it would play up well to Otis's character and to Mandy's character. A part of me still thinks, though, and I thought this from jump when Otis won, is just based on the way they portray him, and, you know, he's really not that bright and he's very easily manipulated, and that somehow he ends up dropping Money in the Bank to somebody else, and maybe it's somebody that Mandy recruits and ends up going with, and she's the reason for it all. Like, I kind of see that maybe being the end game of this storyline, where he ends up transferring that Money in the Bank to somebody else at some point.
Could Mandy end up with Ziggler and Sonya ends up a breakout babyface in all this?
I certainly think that it's possible, because Ziggler is still reluctant to say anything negative about Mandy.
Oh, yeah.
He even says, like, to Sonya, like, take
don't
it easy, don't punch her in the face. And
yep.
Yeah, right. So it's very clear that he still wants to be with Mandy. So I definitely could see that. And then Sonya could say, you know, see, she was a wolf in sheep's clothing all along. I told you about her. And then she really does look like a big time baby face for really, she was being truthful all along and people were mistaking it for her being a bad person. So I think that Mandy and Dolph might still be the end game. And then Money in the Bank goes to Dolph. Cause he, again, he's my first thought for who makes sense for Otis to drop Money in the Bank too, would be Dolph. And then, if anybody could convince Otis to put it on the line and make it seem like she's doing it for the right reasons, it would be Mandy. But ultimately, the big swerve would be her going back with Dolph. So I think that that's probably where I see it going right now.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting. It's because there's no happy ending with Otis. He's not going to – I don't think he's going to become Universal Champion.
No.
But Otis cashing in and then losing is like, oh, man. You know, I mean, like, how fun is that? You know, that's
right. It never really does anything for the person when that happens. Like, Baron Corbin didn't come out of it looking better when it happened to him. Damian Sandow certainly didn't come out of it looking better when it happened to him. It's never a star making moment when you cash in Money in the Bank and don't win.
And Javier emailed and said another option for Otis is Money in the Bank, since he keeps his bratwurst in a briefcase. Which can be a whole new gimmick match, brought worse in a briefcase. The Greeks can ruin the contract, making it illegible and therefore invalid. So thanks for that, Javier.
Great.
I'm not even going to give a second of time to his other part of that email. He also just said no Bray or Fiend this week. Is that true, Mike? I don't think I fast-forwarded past anything.
No, he wasn't on.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of a situation where we're going to see him lay low and the Fiend will kind of surface. Because I think that's the whole story that was told in their match at Money in the Bank, where Bray couldn't get the job done and So the Fiend is going to have to kind of emerge to beat Braun Strowman at some point.
Yeah. Yep. All right. Well, we're an hour and a half plus in here. I'm trying to think if we covered it. We had the hacker guy again.
I felt like I saw that before, though, this week at some point, maybe on WWE Backstage or something like that, almost the same vignette. So it doesn't seem like we're not really getting anywhere with that. It's been a very slow build. I still feel like it's probably Mustafa Ali. I don't see who else it would be.
It sounded like him. It's weird, but because it doesn't have to be him playing the part, like the physical actual shadow figure.
Right.
But it sort of looked like his head and neck, the way he turned around. Like, I don't know him well. You know, I don't know what he looks like from behind sitting in a chair with a hood on. But I was like, this totally seems like Ali to me. So,
and just the logo. It's like the thing that's on his glove, essentially. I'd be very surprised if it wasn't him.
Yeah. And the Forgotten Sons fight for the country, and no one – you know, welcomes them home. So they're going to, instead of open arms, they're going to break everyone's arms. I mean, at least they're defining a better why they have the attitude that they have.
Yeah, they have a character, at least, I guess, which is actually more than they ever had in NXT, which you can't often say. But something.
All right, cool. Well, Mike, tell people about how they can hear more from you, read more from you, social media, podcast, and writing.
Well, yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Mike Chiari, Chiari. You can find at Ring Rust Radio on Twitter also. And, you know, check out Ring Rust Radio every Tuesday night, 9 p.m. Eastern time. We're on Spreaker, but you can really find us anywhere you get your podcasts. We just break down pretty much anything going on in the world of professional wrestling. Obviously, WWE and a lot of NXT and AEW as well, especially in this time when that's really all the stuff that's running. But we get really in depth with everything. And we also look at all the kind of the latest rumors and stuff going on and see what's fact, see what's fiction, and just try to put as much of a entertaining and positive spin on it as we can. So check that out. And also, you can find me at BleacherReport.com, just writing about all things sports, a lot of professional wrestling, obviously, but really anything in the sports world, even with no sports going, just constant flow of news and speculation and rumors about where all this stuff is going to go. So check me out there, BleacherReport.com.
Awesome. Mike, thank you so much. We're glad you're on this week. We had, I think, a really fun discussion on a show that gave us a lot to talk about, and I wasn't necessarily expecting that going in.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought it was an enjoyable SmackDown overall. I thought set the stage for a lot of stuff, and I always have a great time coming on here and talking about all that stuff with you.
Awesome. Thanks, Mike, and thanks to all our listeners. Oh, by the way, follow me on Twitter, at TheWadeKeller, and follow our brand, at PWTorch. And on behalf of Mike Chiari, Wade Keller, thanking our callers and emailers, and signing off for today.